Welcome back, listeners. This is Austin Roberts. Here on the EcoCiv podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and equitable world. If you enjoy this podcast, you can help support the work that we are doing by making a donation at ecociv.org. Today, Jeremy Fackenthal talks with Catherine Keller, who is professor of constructive theology at the Theological School of Drew University. Keller is a leading progressive theologian and process philosopher, whose work attends to matters of social and ecological justice, postmodern philosophy, and feminist theology. She is the author of numerous books, including Face of the Deep, A Theology of Becoming, and Cloud of the Impossible, Negative Theology and Planetary Entanglement. In this episode, Jeremy talks with Catherine about her most recent book, Political Theology of the Earth, Our Planetary Emergency and the Struggle for a New Public, which critically engages the works of Carl Schmitt, Alfred North Whitehead, William Connolly, Donna Haraway, and many others to develop a constructive political theology for the Anthropocene. Catherine talks about the relevance of political theology for the present ecological emergency, the ongoing struggle for an eco-political common good, the complex relationship between theory and practice, and the importance of distinguishing hope from optimism. And now, here's Catherine and Jeremy.
I am here today with Catherine Keller, who is professor of constructive theology at Drew Theological School. Catherine has been a longtime friend and thought partner of many of us and happens to be in Claremont this week. So we grabbed her for an interview about her most recent book, Political Theology of the Earth, Our Planetary Emergence and the Struggle for a New Public. Catherine, first, let me just say that this book pairs really well with our recent read and podcast interview of Yael Dennis. So we're diving back into Schmitt and sovereignty and state of exception questions again with this, and then going a bit further to talk about planetary politics and democratic agonism, which we'll draw out in a few minutes. So thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here, and of course being here is being close to the source for me of any reflection that I can be part of about the Earth and indeed about political theology.
Can you first just tell us why you wrote this book and why you wrote this book now?
Well, yes, Jeremy, now is the question and provides the context. Of course, the now is a flexible time, and it seems like this book was written in response to the emergency triggered by the 2016 election. But in fact, I had already gotten a draft together because I was doing this originally in the form of three lectures for the Taylor Lectures at Yale Divinity School. So just saying, I'd already gotten a sense that I needed to work on a political theology as a way of grappling with a sense of planetary crisis that was very much tuned to the planet as such, as our home, and as the place that we know is now for our long-term habitation under threat by our long-term habits. And so already I was moving in pretty much this direction, but I needed to do quite a lot of rewriting after the election. It was sad to have to include quotes of the present president. but really, I came to a sense of a sort of triple emergency that I hope to help morph into a triple site of emergence, a kind of triune apocalypse that is, of course, of climate change, which is so much in our immediate future, and of the political condition, which is so much in our face, and at the same time of theology and of its religious institutional base, with the ongoing crises of Christendom, of my denomination and that of Claremont's, and mm-hmm. of my school, Druze, the United Methodists, have gone into a deep self-destructive crisis just in the last couple of months. So there's a triple sense of threat, but I always, when meditating on the apocalypse, need to remind myself and anyone listening of the meaning of the word, which is not to close down history. It's not the end of time. It's not closure. It's disclosure. It's revelation. It's an opening up of possibilities under extremely dire circumstances. So I think that's where we are. There, it's not about the end of the world. Apocalypse is not about the end of the world. There is no end of the world anywhere in the Bible. Mm-hmm. There are great catastrophes, natural and historical, and there are prophetic warnings of more to come. Mm-hmm. But there is, at the same time, always a radical hope mm-hmm. for a fresh start. So, yeah, I'm hoping in this moment to just be one of a multitude of voices trying to help us galvanize our resources spiritually, mentally, mm-hmm. and very practically.
Picking up on that, you you draw on both the writings of Paul and on some of the recent postmodern philosophical return to Paul. Can you describe how that is significant for you and how it's significant for you as a process relational theologian and thinker?
Yes, it's an odd significance. Odd in the way that my occasionally now looping back to John of Patmos and his misogynist grim apocalypse is, like looping back to Paul in spite of clearly sexist and heterosexist passages that have been used for much harm. But I've been convinced less by the scholarship of biblical scholars, which I tend to take with a grain of salt because they might be trying to apologize for him, and more from these philosophers who've become enraptured with Paul, even though these philosophers are basically continental atheists. Agamben, Badiou, Zizek all have books on Paul. And what's very interesting is that their books on Paul go hand in hand with the books that each of them have written on political theology. Again, not as theologians. And this is what's interested me in political theology. It's this interdisciplinary possibility of a conversation. So I was hooked into a new fascination with Paul that I really wouldn't have expected, and particularly through Agamben's discussion of 1 Corinthians 7. And this is where we hear from Paul in the normal translation that the time that remains is short. But what Agamben points out is that the word for short is much, much more complicated and interesting than what that monosyllable carries. It's sunestalmenos, which actually means contracted or ingathered or compressed or complicated. So this completely hooked me back in. So it's not that we're running out of time, mm-hmm. though of course we might be in a certain sense, but that's not the core of the message. And if that were Paul's message, it would just be evidence of how wrong he was expecting mm-hmm. the world to end a couple thousand years ago, more or less. No, it's precisely that this sunestalmenos of time, this contraction of time, the sense that time is contracted, is about a great ingathering of the density of our history and of what's possible to us. So there is intensity in it, there is risk, there is danger, and there is great possibility. And what's also interesting is that he doesn't use the word chronos for the time that is short, it's kairos. And you don't have to be a follower of Paul Tillich to know that Paul's kairos is of deep metaphysical significance. I, of course, link the kairos, which is, again, a moment of the fullness of time. It's not just a fleeting moment, a moment of the fullness of time, but of crisis, but also of possibility. I link it to Whitehead's sense of any moment of time, any moment of becoming, actually being a contraction of all of history, of all of the universe. Mm-hmm. So you see where this begins to cohere with my process theology, that there's something about the moment that we are in that Paul is also negotiating in his moment. He's not talking about one single moment in time, but the moment in which we as followers of the Messiah might find ourselves if we open our eyes together. We find ourselves often in such a moment and in some unique way, and we are in a unique way in a moment of great contraction where we're becoming aware of what danger our habitable oikos, our home, on the planet is, and yet also we are becoming aware of us as a planetary population, and new media does at least serve that purpose of contracting our awareness of what's going on everywhere. So I wanted Paul to be part of this political theology, which you can also therefore call a political theology.
I actually did laugh out loud the first time you used that phrase in the book. It was quite delightful.
I'm sure I haven't been the first to think of it, but yeah. I was the first to be smart alecky enough to use it.
Yeah. And it seems that connected with this kairos moment, or as Benjamin calls it, the Jetztzeit or the now time, is also Schmitt's notion of the state of exception, or what becomes the state of emergency in some of Benjamin's writings. Can you describe briefly, just for our listeners' sake, how Schmitt understands sovereignty and what the state of exception means for him, and then perhaps why that can be troubling in the present?
Yes, really important question, Jeremy. And I'm glad that many of your listeners will have already heard Yael Shelley Dennis reflecting on political theology, her political theology of food, and therefore have gotten some exposure to this problematic return to 1920s text of Carl Schmitt called Political Theology. And it opens with the claim that sovereign is he who decides in the exception. Sovereign is he who decides in, or it can be translated on, the exception. So Schmitt was, of course, appealing to the power that the sovereign ruler, if he is truly sovereign, has to declare a state of emergency, to decide if it is one or isn't, and to declare it, which means that law is suspended. So the sovereign lawmaker is also the one who can suspend the laws and in that way transcend law. And of course, this is partly why Schmitt was useful to his Führer, who in 1933 declared a state of emergency that was then permanent. So that state of exception or state of emergency is the same term in German, then is a way of getting at a crisis. And I don't want to dispute that there are states of emergency that might need to be declared. And David Griffin has suggested that the President of the United States, he was writing before we had this one, should declare a state of climate emergency. And I think that's a discussion worth having. Mm-hmm. But this notion of power is very dangerous because it is the excuse to suspend the constitutional rules that govern a democracy and that maintain checks and balances on power. Naturally, we're already in a state of emergency, though it's become a very strange, self-contradicting one in our present context. Early in this millennium, a state of emergency was actually in effect in relation to the Iraq War that in many ways has never been ended. That's something Agamben also wrote about and was deeply worried about the United States' role, and that's under Bush too. So this notion of a sovereign exception is an important clue as to a way that power can be abused with an aura of legitimacy, you know, serving the nation in an emergency. And this is what pumps up then a dictatorial kind of power or a more total power. So it seems to me that as we face into emergencies of various kinds, and certainly we're just going to keep seeing spirals of social and ecological emergency developing as the waters rise and as the droughts persist and as the wild fires come on here in this state year after year, worse and worse. So they're going to be emergencies. Can't avoid that term. And so it seems to me crucial to think of other strategies than the state of emergency and its kind of sovereign exceptionalism as a way of getting at it. So instead of seeing climate emergency as a big exception, we should see it as, in fact, an exemplification of patterns that have been in play for the 500 years of modernity and of our pumping of fossil fuels into the atmosphere, starting with the coal revolution in England. And that pumping, and you can date the Anthropocene to then, or you can date it to the 1950s when we reach a whole new level of the extractivism that's poisoning and warming our atmosphere. Whenever you date it from, it's a long process that the present emergency is exemplifying, and it's going into new levels and qualitative differences. But it's important not to see it just as an exception, or else mm-hmm. we're not diagnosing properly. Mm-hmm. So that's why then I'm proposing instead of a sovereign state of exception, a collective state of inception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. And you use a couple of phrases to articulate that inception. One of them is the undercommons, and then you also describe the notion of democratic agonism. Can you walk us through what each of those mean and how each term is helpful for building this sort of collective amongst and amidst our differences?
Yes. Well, starting with the undercommons, which is a phrase that is the name of an amazing book by Fred Moten and Milam Harney. And what Moten and Harney are getting at in the undercommons is a sense of black urgency indeed a black emergency. And they're talking of an undercommons rather than something that we can discuss as in terms of a commonwealth where things are in common, because they're speaking for a minority who don't seem to count to our commonwealth's understanding of the common good. Nonetheless, I, as a pupil of John Cobb and one very influenced by his For the Common Good, want to hold out for an understanding of the political as the struggle for a common good. But if that good is going to be truly a common good, one for all citizens in common, one for all human beings ultimately to hold in common, and if we're real white Whiteheadians, one for all creatures ultimately to share in common in our endlessly diverse ways. If we're going to have that radical sense of an eco-political common good as what guides our political struggle together, then we have to be faithful to the undercommons. So I want now always to be echoing Fred Moten when I appeal to a common good, you know, that it has to be a common good that keeps faith, that checks in with the undercommons, though understanding that we can't appropriate that language and that subject location either in some big, wide, and largely white we.
Right.
So that's the sense of the commons with its closely shadowing truth-speaking undercommons as the site of a collective inception rather than the sovereign exception, which accepts itself from the commons. That's it's the uncommon that accepts itself. Oh, and the etymology of exception is to take out. So it takes itself out of the commons and, of course, takes out a lot of the commoners, shoves them into the the undercommons.
Another concept that comes out early in the book and then sort of stays with us through the remainder is Chantal Mouffe's notion of democratic agonism. And you write that this agonism is not enmity, but struggle, and that it's important to stay with that struggle. Can you draw out what you mean by democratic agonism and then how that plays a role in this political theology?
Yes, I find it a very illuminating idea, this contrasting of a democratic agonism to a public antagonism. And more than Chantal Mouffe, I'm really taking it actually from William Connolly, who speaks of a respectful agonism, again, over and against a politics of antagonism. And with Mouffe, the agonism is directly juxtaposed to Carl Schmitt, who defines the political in terms of friendship. That is, the friendship of a shared, unified public. And how does it unify itself? By designating a common enemy. So for Schmitt, there is no politics and there is no unity without the enemy. So you can see how the Jews were really important to him and his crowd, because they helped to galvanize a new Aryan unity. But of course, we all know the advantage of having a common enemy. It always worked well in my family, which was full of internal divisions and antagonisms, but if we could unify against someone else, you know, I learned that trick very early, and here I am trying to create some unity with my readers and listeners against, like, Carl Schmitt. So it's not that I think we have an easy pair of alternatives here, but I think we have a good normative idea, if not ideal, in the agonism, which is a word that means struggle, and you hear in the agon, which in the Greek means struggle and is also the root for agony. So this isn't something nicey-nice, harmonious and easy, but agonism isn't defined in an over and against with an enemy. It might be an agon with a true declared enemy, of course. Even if we believe in loving thine enemy, we're not denying that we have enemies. Mm-hmm. We might hope to transform the relationship of enmity into another kind of difference. But the enemy might stay an enemy and crucify us. That's just realistic. But agonism doesn't require an enemy. It can also be the struggle with, the struggle with each other to reach new understandings, the struggle with one another to build a vital coalition so that our multiple identities don't lock into single issue politics and just let ourselves then be divided and conquered by the real enemies. So it's important that we go on struggling with each other around what's most important at this moment in history. Is it climate change, as I sometimes am saying, or is it that Black Lives Matter, or is it the return of toxic masculinity, or is it that, you know, given where the UMC is it that queer lives matter? So we have issues that become emergencies and demand burning focus and attention. But an agonism would say, let's not go antagonistic around what is the most important issue. Let's try to keep struggling with each other so that we can build a strong enough coalition across the democratic spectrum. And I think agonism will serve us far better than antagonism in that struggle.
From that, I want to ask you about hope, because it seems that hope for you in this book is tied to that agonism, and that hope is not an escape from the struggle, but perhaps even diving further into the struggle or remaining with the struggle. You talk about hope as the embrace of possibility and staying with the trouble for more than just a moment. And you say that hope cannot be confused with optimism. We often ask people, our guests on our podcast, where they see hope. But I want to ask that question differently for you. So how does a political theology include hope in this sort of realistic manner, I guess?
Hope is a very fragile concept right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, with even a theologian writing a book called The Embrace of Hopelessness, as though that's the only... Miguel de la Torres wrote that.
Yeah.
It's an important argument to make, and I want to agonistically struggle with it. I am tuned to a lot of thinkers, authors who have given up on a concept of hope and propose alternatives. Don Haraway, and staying with the trouble, thinks that staying with the trouble is a way of staying vibrantly and materially engaged in the present. Staying with the troubles now and relinquishes a concept of hope because of its future reference. So again, I learned so much from her and from many thinkers who have dumped hope. But it is my conviction that hope is a more important concept than what intellectuals think we can play with, and that to give up on hope is to give up on the future referent of our current struggles. It's to give up on the sense that there's something to struggle for beyond the immediate moment. But of course, I have an understanding of the immediate moment that's Whiteheadian and that believes that the future is already in play in mm-hmm. the present, not mm-hmm. as predictable. It's not predictable, not as somehow already there, no, but as possibility. It's being shaped right here now. So it's not something abstract and distant. It's there interacting with the past, which is also mm-hmm. there. So for me, the Kairos moment of the Jetztzeit, the now moment, is vibrantly engaging what's possible. And what's possible can only become actual in a future. It might be a very near future, or it might be a more distant one. But hope is the dimension of struggle in time that references that future. Mm. So I don't think we can afford to let it go. What I think we have to do is continuously distinguish between optimism and hope. So I just over and over repeat that my one favorite quote from Karl Barth, really my only, is that Christians are not optimistic or pessimistic. We are hopeful. That works for mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. Hope is a rigorous prophetic concept. It really only arises in the Hebrew prophetic tradition mm-hmm. as a significant ethical value. Doesn't arise anywhere else around the planet yeah. as a primary value. And I think we need it, but it's a hard hope because it isn't a guarantee. There might even be some sense of divine promise, but these promises require our collaboration. They're covenants. They mm-hmm. require that we fulfill our part in the covenant. We need to do our bit to realize these divinely proffered possibilities, these lures. And we seem as a species, and especially as the privileged white minority of the species, to be undoing our part rather than doing our part in mm-hmm. in fulfilling the covenant and making hope realizable. But we can't mm-hmm. erase hope, therefore we have to struggle harder. So I love the title of Joseph Winter's book, Hope Draped in Black. Mm-hmm. That means a lot to me. That's a hope that is in some way shadowed, even shrouded, by immense historical loss. Mm-hmm. And he's thinking of massive enslavement and genocide of Africans and of African Americans and all that has been suffered racially. Whatever gains come about, the grief work isn't then done. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of hope you have actually in the biblical prophetic tradition. It's full of lament. It's working through great mourning, great loss, great suffering. And therefore, it can glimpse hope. Mm-hmm. Without the mourning, hope isn't hope, it's optimism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, hope in the dark also is then Rebecca Solnit's phrase. She's a great activist on ecological matters. So it's this darkened, this shadowed hope that mm-hmm. I find realistic.
You talk about sort of the sin of white supremacy and how that has been tied to Christendom and a certain kind of Christianity. And in that discussion, you introduce the idea of failing better. So there's not a sense in which we won't continue to fail at certain things in the future, but that we can fail better. How, for you, is that notion of failing better tied to Deleuze's understanding of repetition with a difference?
So repetition with a difference from Gilles Deleuze, from his great work in the late 60s, Repetition and Difference, is actually a point where the early influence on him of Whitehead, mm-hmm. I believe, bleeds through. And he references Whitehead later in that book. He's one of the only continental philosophers who did.
Yeah.
And so what he's thinking about is about how novelty is radical. It's what I want to call the inception. Mm-hmm. And he's a great philosopher of the new and the different, but it's not a dissociated difference. It's mm-hmm. not a difference out of nothing. Mm-hmm. It's out of the past. And the past is endlessly repeating itself with a kind of inertive force, as in Whitehead. Mm-hmm. It's endlessly repeating itself in every moment, but in that moment, there's also always, even at the most microcosmic, trivial little quantum level, some element of new possibility for some different twist. Mm-hmm. And for Deleuze, that idea is also cosmological, not just human and not just political, but very political. So that the past is always present, contracting in the present, but in that contraction, something novel is possible. Even the sheer fact that it's a repetition means it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mm-hmm. repetition. That's mm-hmm. other than what it is repeating. So that's this Whitehead-Deleuze idea. And your question's really great. So how does that relate to Jack Haberstam's concept of the queer art of failure? Because mm-hmm. that's where this notion of failing better comes from, the queer art of failure. And what Haberstam is talking about is how there's something powerful in being wrong and in losing and failing. But they say that all our failures combined might be just enough if we really practice them to get beyond winning, even to bring down the winner on, on the other side. And yet, their concept is that the most we can hope for really is to fail better, more knowingly. And, you know, I realized that this concept of failing better is actually coming from Samuel Beckett. Mm-hmm. His last play, which is a wonderful little play called Worstward Ho. What a pun that is. Worstward Ho. Talking about U.S. exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And what Samuel Beckett has his character there mutter towards the end is, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better. So that's repetition with a difference and a hard-earned struggling difference,
yeah.
But better.
I would be remiss if I did not bring out the fact that this is, in fact, a political theology. And so while EcoCiv is not necessarily a faith-based organization, we intertwine ourselves with people of faith quite frequently, and our organization is made up of people of faith. I wanted to ask you about this notion of the messianic. And the way that you draw out the fact that incarnation, so God incarnate in the world, underscores the fact that matter matters. At the same time, you draw from Benjamin, who says that we have or we carry with us a weak messianic power, and that the past has a sort of claim on that weak messianic power. I wonder to what degree you would also say that the future has a claim on that weak messianic power.
Oh, that's a great and very contracted question.
Mm.
So this concept of weak messianic power from Walter Benjamin has been very important to a whole series of thinkers, many of them in the continental non-theist philosophical mm-hmm. tradition, others reflecting on Judaism, in deep ways, like Jakob Taubes, who also took Schmidt very seriously and very painfully. And also with Jack Caputo, thinking through Derrida, really picking up this concept of a weak power as a way of thinking about a non-omnipotent God. And, you know, for us who've worked with process theology, the resonance with the persuasive but non-coercive divine power is deep. The resonance with the God who, in the name of Tom Ward's new bestseller, God can't is the name of the deconstruction of classical omnipotence in process theology leads to a place that's very similar. They're not the same as this weak messianic force. I think we don't like to say this is that God's weak. We like to say it's an alternative power, power of persuasion, or I like to say, yes, the power of love, that what God can't be is in contradiction to God's self, and if God is love, then God can't exercise manipulative power. I think Ord and I agree on that one. So the weak messianic power has particular reference to the Jewish expectation of the Messiah, which some set of Jews thought had already been fulfilled, but only partially, because still that Messiah didn't bring on the messianic age, and so had to still somehow come. In the future, come again or come for the first time, depending on your religious community. So that sense of messianic hope seems to me to be crucial to any vibrant concept of hope. There's a messianic edge to it, however fully secularized it is. And with Walter Benjamin, it was radically secularized, as was his Judaism. So that's part of thinking with the political theology that from the opposite politics comes out of Schmidt, that, you know, is the argument that all modern political concepts are secularized theology. But so we from the left, he's thinking of omnipotence and that how secularized omnipotence yields the sovereign exceptionalist power. But I think we might think about how secularized messianic power, or call it potentiality, that secularized messianic hope can then express itself through a new collective planetary inception that is secular religious, that bridges that difference, that operates with wisdom back and forth, and so seeks to materialize its hope in a way that is in cahoots with all of our material shared life, which is why with the physicist and thinker Karen Barad, we understand that there's an ethical marrow running through matter itself. Matter matters, and we know that in process theology, in process philosophy, that matter is never merely matter. And so that this mattering that happens in the secularizing of a weak messianic power is, I think, a kind of always very fragile realization of hope. But as soon as we use any messianic language, whether we're using it in a secularized way or in a still Jewish or Christian theological way, I think we need to keep faith with that undercommons, and I'm thinking of J. Cameron Carter's analysis of the the messianic white man in U.S. politics, and that's the politics that is triumphant, very triumphant right now. So we always need to distinguish indeed, not just distinguish from, but oppose to that messianic white men, when we want to use any messianic metaphor, warn against the white God messianism that the Christian right has teamed up with the political right and with a bizarre breaking form of neoliberal capitalism to bring us to this particular edge of history.
Toward the end of the book, you move into some practical applications or some concrete ways in which perhaps we are at least attempting to fail better. And it, what struck me most about that is that there is a way in which you bridge together the theoretical with the practical within this volume. And for EcoCiv, that is certainly something that we consciously consider in our work. So we talk about deepening our idea or our understanding of an ecological civilization, but always combining that with practical or on-the-ground work in trying to transform structures and systems. How do you see, either within this volume or within the body of your work thus far, this connection between theory and practice?
Right. Well, there's nothing more important than that connection. And it's not enough to say, as some academics are wont to, that theory is practice.
Right.
Well, of course it is. But yep. it can be a very irresponsible practice if it's not thinking rather consistently and mindfully about how to move into material practices that actually influence vast networks of life. You know, but just saying that we want that to happen doesn't make it happen. And I think I'm, in my work, often guilty of talking about practice as though that's already practicing. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think there's some vicious circles that we get into there. Yet I think there are also a lot of vicious circles that activists get into. You're thinking, just do it. Well, if we could just do it, we would have done it already.
Yeah.
You know, and so we actually have to be thoughtful in our activism, because there's huge choices to be made all the time, because our priorities are going to guide us and our possibilities are limited. But I don't know of better examples right now of the crossing from theory into its practices and the checking of theory by practices than what you all are doing at the Process Institute through this work on EcoCiv. That's why actually I bring in that work and John Cobb's work and Philip Clayton's in particular as illustrations, you know, with the kind of extraordinary effect that process thought has had in mainland China.
Yeah.
With those, I think now at 30 centers.
36.
36 now,
yes.
Oh my goodness. Every time I mention it, there are several more centers for process thought. And really that means if we're pursuing the ideal of ecological civilization, that is part of Chinese self-understanding. Mm-hmm. And as John Cobb has said for many decades now, would make a tremendous difference to any degree to which it's actualized, simply because of the size of the population and the scale of the power and influence and wealth of what's involved in the concept of mainland China. And so that work has seemed to me an extraordinary example of a theory having practical impact. And the effect here in Southern California of Pando Populus and EcoCiv's involvement in creating that amazing web network root system, or is it a branching system? Anyway, the tree is branching out, and that tree, which is tens of thousands of trees, is endlessly intermingling and growing in its undercommons of roots, but connecting multiple activist groups and priorities together, and it takes rigorous thought to be doing that.
Right.
But that's what you're doing here, and I'm only indirectly involved. You know, my work has often, through my decades, been in relation to particularly struggles around gender, and then gender and ecology within church communities, often Protestant ones, but actually, I'm also involved with some Catholic follow-through on the encyclical. I'll be doing a keynote lecture at the opening of the Laudato Si Institute in Oxford summer. Very strange to choose a Protestant feminist to do one of the three keynotes for that new institute that will be dedicated to ecological follow-through. So is that practical work? Well, I have to think that that is. Mm-hmm. That's really institutional in a way that's designed to foster more and more church activism and as much non-church and cultural and secular and interreligious activism as also possible. So I think it's through feminist and many queer forms also of networking, connecting to ecological work that I've felt I've been able to be a theoretical resource, but a lot of the activism of one who teaches is actually in the teaching, because I'm not just teaching people who become scholars.
Yeah.
It's a privilege to do some of that as well, but most of the students I teach become ministers of various kinds or activists and leaders of social institutions. So always I'm afraid I'm just trying to justify the privilege of writing more books, but I hope it's more than that that we're up to here.
I think it is. Yeah, thank you. And I would say that your theory and body of work contributes to our work and helps us deepen our understanding of integral ecology, of ecological civilization. And it certainly fuels the work that we do. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. What you're up to is indeed mattering.